I think most of the people in the world who we would say are missionary are really kind of, you know, it came to them, so to speak. And then I spent 10 years building a Medicare Advantage related company that actually, you know, didn't turn out nearly as well as my first two enterprises that turned out. And then I saw ChatGPT and said, oh my God, this is what I've been waiting for. Like the opportunity to combine my AI expertise and knowledge and with my healthcare passion and really build a next generation company that combines those two things.
And now from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
In a world where technology and healthcare converge, Munjal Xia, co-founder and CEO of Hippocratic AI, stands as a beacon of innovation and resilience. His journey began in the heart of Silicon Valley, where an early exposure to technology seeded a lifelong passion. Munjal's path was not always clear-cut, but his determination to make a meaningful impact in the tech world never wavered. From founding companies that caught the eye of a tech giants like Google and Alibaba, to a personal health scare that pivoted his focus towards AI in healthcare, Munjal's story is a testament to adaptability and vision. Today, as the leader of Hippocratic AI, Munjal is pioneering a new era where technology doesn't just support healthcare, but transforms it at its core, ensuring safety and accessibility for all. In this episode, we will explore Munjal's revolutionary approach to integrating AI into healthcare, his unique approach in entrepreneurship, and the profound lessons from his journey as CEO. We will gain insights into the challenges of blending AI with healthcare, understand his perspective on the future of this rapidly evolving field, and hear the inspiring story of how personal experiences shape his professional path. Here's our conversation. Well, welcome, Munjal. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's exciting to have you here. And I always like to start our conversation with our guest journey. And you have quite an interesting path. You cover a lot of different ground as well as co-founders in many different companies. You definitely are serial entrepreneurs, but in a different, many different spaces. Mm-hmm. And tell us how you get through navigate all those things and how you get here.
You know, it's not a straightforward journey. I mean, I think I always knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. You know, I grew up in Silicon Valley, actually. Very few people seem to grow up here who are in tech. Like everybody migrates here. But I literally grew up in a small middle-class city called Campbell. And the guy across the street from me made video games for Atari. And if you mowed his lawn, you could get early access to the games. And so he had the best looking lawn in the neighborhood because every kid went and mowed his lawn and trimmed his flowers. And I had learned to program at a very early age as well. But I think that I knew I wanted to create one. I just didn't know when, where, and how. And I remember in college thinking of trying to create some, but never kind of really did it. And then after my graduate school, I ended up creating kind of my first company. And we built that company and you know, it was in a different space. It was an e-commerce company that built a SaaS platform for small businesses to sell on marketplaces like eBay. And we eventually sold that to Alibaba. And then my graduate work had all been in AI, and I really wanted to create an AI company. And so my second company was a computer vision company where we used computer vision to look inside of photographs at the color, shape, and pattern, and we used it for shopping. And said, oh, you know, can upload a picture of a dress or a handbag or shoes, and we'd find you visually similar items you could buy. Mm-hmm. And Google bought that company, and we... I became part of the Google shopping team. I actually ran shopping for a little while at Google, and you know, everything seemed great. But the day after I sold the company to Google, literally the very next day, I was on a run And I ended up with chest pains and I ended up in the ER. And I was 37 at the time. My dad had had his first heart attack in his mid-40s. So it wasn't like I had good genes. I had really bad Indian genes, right? You know, so I lost 30, 40 pounds. I'm not that tall. I'm like 5'6". So 30, 40 pounds is actually a lot for somebody in my frame. And changed my health and really got into nutrition and education and even health. I took a class at Stanford in endocrinology in the extension program, and I loved it. Actually, I realized that had I taken this in college, I would have chosen this over computer science even. maybe I liked endocrinology because it's kind of a systems view of the body. And I was just fascinated. I remember the first day, my wife was like, "God, they gave you 7 hours of homework?" And I was like, "No, I'm seven chapters ahead because I just kept reading. It was so interesting." And so then I said, "Look, you know, if I'm going to build a company, I'm going to build another one around healthcare because I'm really passionate about this." And so I think a lot of times people say you should go find your mission in life. And I actually have the opposite saying. I'm like, I think your mission finds you. Like, you just have to be receptive and you just have to like be open to it. But I don't, you know, I think most of the people in the world who we would say are missionary are really kind of, you know, it came to them, so to speak. And so, and then I spent 10 years building a Medicare Advantage related company. That actually, you know, didn't turn out nearly as well as my first two enterprises had turned out. And then I saw ChatGPT and said, "Oh my God, this is what I've been waiting for." Like the opportunity to combine my AI expertise and knowledge and with my healthcare passion and really build a next generation company that combines those two things. And so that's how I got here. You know, along the way, I helped a lot of my friends start companies and invested in them and in some cases sat on the board. And so I love the process of creating companies. I think it's such a fun, creative process. It's like, you know, painting a new painting kind of thing. But it's just been a journey through, you know, now this is my fourth company. So
yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned about you love the part of the creating journey. And share with us, what does that mean when you say the creating journey? And when you start a company, what are the fun part?
You know, I think coming up with the initial idea. Like so many people out there, I think are very, they want to start a company, but they don't take the time to have the creative process to really come up with a unique business idea and then test that idea. But, you know, and you see this, it's like when Uber came out, there was like 30 more startups that were the Uber for X, right? We're going to deliver this thing. We're going to deliver that thing. We're going to come wash your car, you know, and it's like,
that's, I like that though, the washing my car.
Yeah, it seemed like a good idea, but it turned out it was really bad business, I think, because that company went out of business. But like, you know, I think there are so many cases where people just think very linearly and they don't think kind of expansively around it and just don't apply creativity to saying, especially when a new platform comes out, right? Like think of the top 10 apps when the Apple iPhone came out. They were like alarm clock and stopwatch and fart noises. I mean, they were, right? That's what they were, if you remember. And then nobody in the first wave was like, you know what? I want an app that lets me call a taxi, but it's not a taxi. And I want to watch it coming so I know how far it away. And then when I get out, I don't want to have to pay and pull out my card and fumble with it. I just want it to work.
Right.
Like nobody came up with that in the first, what, 2, 3, 4 years? And it took a while for people to have the creativity and the imagination to be like, well, if I have this phone that's connected all the time and has GPS.
So what is, you know, for those who are interested and so that more people can benefit from other people's creativity, like what do you have a process on going through that creative to come up with something that is creative rather than just, like you said, linear?
You know, I do actually. I have actually a course I once taught, or a talk I gave, actually, I shouldn't say a course, but a talk I gave on this. And there are some techniques that I actually talk about. There's about four different techniques to coming up with startup ideas. One of them is, you know, find a unique data set. You know, like the NHANES data that's out there is an amazing data set that you can download and analyze and slice and dice 20 different ways and find some really unique health insights. We actually did that in one of the company creations I was involved with. My first company, also, we came up with building tools for sellers on eBay because we analyzed all the eBay transactions and realized it wasn't a person-to-person marketplace. It was a small business sales channel. The other one is, you know, look for new laws to change. Like I talked to the, what was the founder of, what was the company? It wasn't Roman. It was the company just like it, though. I forgot the name of it. That does, that was, you know, basically one of the first to let you get Viagra and Cialis and all that online. And they, and I remember speaking to the CEO and I'm like, why now? It's like, well, this new law just got passed allowing physicians to basically do telemedicine in other states where they don't have a license. So kind of nationalize their license. And he said, and, you know, I think Viagra or Cialis, one of the two had just come off a patent. And he was like, this is why now men don't want to necessarily go in and talk about these issues directly with the doctor. They'd honestly prefer to do it virtually because it's a very sensitive kind of issue. And so he said, this is why now. And sometimes new laws come out and they kind of enable whole new things. And I always tell people, like, actually pay attention, like, because some of those will allow for a whole new business to be created that wasn't. And there's a few other techniques that, you know, we can go into. But, like, there are very – people think this is, like, eureka. You just sit there one day and you come to it. But actually, there are systematic strategies you can use to come up with good startup ideas.
You mentioned the four pieces. You mentioned the first two. What's the other two?
One of them is actually a filtering technique that I call breadth-first search. So it's actually a computer science term. So in computer science, there's something called depth-first search and breadth-first search. So depth-first search, you go deep into a thing and see if it's there, and then you go deep into the next one. And breadth-first search, you kind of go shallow across a bunch of them, and then you go slowly deeper into all of them. And what you find when you do a startup is you can, like, you'll just convince yourself an idea is good. In fact, the more research you'll do into it, the more you'll think it's a good idea. And especially if you're burning through your savings and you're, you know, kind of like, you'll be like, okay, well, this is the idea. We should go for it. And what I found is nobody can maintain objectivity about whether something is a good idea. And the only way to do that is to have multiple ideas in parallel and do this breath first search. So I literally recommend on Monday, you analyze idea one. On a Tuesday, you analyze idea two. And you do that for five ideas, 5 days a week. And then you go back. And then you don't narrow until you've done that for a while. And then you go, okay, now I'll cut it down to three ideas. And then you do it for three ideas. And then you cut it down to two ideas. And then you do it two. The comparative process helps you maintain your objectivity. Mm-hmm. And that is, and you need that because, again, you'll just kind of convince yourself that it's a, you know, a really good idea otherwise.
Right.
And then the last one is, you know, bet, which is really the one we did for Hippocratic, which is bet on a new platform. When there's usually this 2x2 grid, and think of it as things have a high barrier to entry or a low barrier to entry, and things have a high margin and low margin. And usually everything that has a high barrier entry has a high margin, and everything that has a low barrier entry is the bottom corner that has a low margin. But what happens when a new platform comes out is something that will eventually have a high margin and for a short period of time has a low barrier to entry. And so when the internet came out, this was true. You could start a new internet business and it was a low barrier to entry, but eventually some of those businesses became very high margin businesses. Same thing happened in social networking. Same thing happened in iPhone apps. You know, you could create a whole new iPhone app like Runkeeper when Nike was the big running brand, and you couldn't have done that. Like, people would have, you know, without the new platform shift, you couldn't have kind of dominated and created a whole new exercise app like that. And so, but, you know, what happens is you've got to kind of chase every new platform shift. Because some of them, like Google Glass, you could have thought, oh my God, this is going to enable all these new things in medicine. And it kind of really didn't, right? So, and so you will be wrong in that, but you have to be there so early that you have to take the risk that the platform doesn't work. Because by the time you know the platform's going to work, it's too late, right? The guy who came early is now has the lead. And so, but the platform shifts are the biggest opportunities in all of tech, I actually find. In fact, of all four idea ways to come up with ideas, I have found that betting on a new platform shift, because platform shifts basically make the incumbents lose all their incumbency, all their advantage. And it's your big opportunity to build something.
And for somebody as a startup, that's you have all the flexibility and nimbleness to take the opportunity.
And it usually requires a new technical expertise that's very different from before. So they don't necessarily have that expertise. So like you know, Gen AI, especially like back up to when we started Hippocratic, like in February, like no one is an expert in Gen AI. I mean, maybe a few people who worked at OpenAI are, and a few others maybe, you know, at Anthropic in a few places, but there was like 100 people, 200 people in the world that were experts. Like, fine, you could go become an expert. And, you know, that's kind of what we did. We spent 3 months reading every paper, researching everything on it. I mean, I had an AI background, but I didn't have a Gen AI background. And then I found some co-founders who did, but like, you know, you kind of have to beef up. But when something's brand new, like, there's not a lot to beef up on because nobody knows a lot. So you can kind of do it very quickly. But these platform shifts are the big opportunities. They create the most disruptive change and they lower the barrier to entry for new people dramatically. And so you run as fast as you can when you see a platform shift.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping medtech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So tell me about Hippocratic AI. You touched on a little bit about it, but tell us more about it.
Yeah. So we're creating a large language model for healthcare. And we're creating a large language model for healthcare, not for diagnoses, not for pharma and drug design. So you've seen AlphaFold and things like that. We're not creating those. When you look at the healthcare system, it's $4.2 trillion. $600 billion-ish is drugs. If you take all the amounts that are paid to doctors, it's about $660 billion, by the way. So let's use that as a proxy for diagnoses. It's not a perfect proxy, but I mean, you get kind of my point. That's $1.2 trillion there. I'm like, what about the other $3 trillion? Like, what is that? What are we spending all this money on? And can we use generative AI to really automate a lot of those things and use generative AI to make those more efficient and just deliver better care? And I think that's what we're after is, you know, doing that. And so we're building a large language model. We believe that you got to go safety first. Well, first of all, the one way to emphasize safety is not do diagnoses. Like, and by the way, every conversation I have, every physician in the room tries to drag me back to, but if you did do diagnoses, I'm like, no, I said we're not doing diagnoses. Like, I cannot be more clear. It's on my homepage, like right underneath the logo, you know, or underneath the like splash image. And then like the first thing it says. And I just don't think these things are safe for that. But I think there's a ton of things you can do that are not diagnoses. So then you build this language model. You train it on healthcare specific content, which is mostly like if you look at it, a lot of it's not on the internet. For good reasons. So we went and found, you know, that content and licensed it, you know, properly. And then you give it a voice. We actually believe a lot of healthcare is done through the telephone, for better or for worse, right? Like it's how, especially older patients and patients who are, less well-served, they may not have an internet connection. They may not have an smartphone, but they all can pick up the phone and talk. And so we realized there's a universality to that. And there's also things you can only get through voice. Like, you know, there's a difference between my back hurts. Mm-hmm. And in a voice conversation, I can tell that difference if I build a tone detector and build some. So now imagine you have a language model that talks. Now, what do you do with that? Right? You know, and we're focused on basically helping to solve the staffing problem in healthcare. right? We have a huge shortage of nurses. We have a huge shortage of almost all clinical workers. And it's not okay that we have that shortage. Like, it means people get their appointments pushed out. Like, it has to be, right? Like, that has to be true. And we know diagnosing things later isn't good, especially in certain things like cancer. And so the sooner we can get you in for an appointment, the better. Like, that is our jobs in the healthcare system, to ensure we have capacity to meet the demands and the needs. And we need to be patient first. And that's my view, is that, you know, we really, really should ensure we have capacity. But here's what language models can do. They can provide this capacity with quite a level of IQ, right? Meaning, or just general healthcare intelligence. We've shown our language models can pass every last healthcare certification out there, the NAPLEX, the pharmacy exam, the NCLEX, the nurses exam, board certifications for OBGYN, for physicians. Like, so now you have something that's smart. You have something that knows healthcare. You have something that can speak. It'll cost about 18 cents an hour to run, by the way. So it costs almost nothing. Now, what would you do with this? And the big idea we have is not just solve staffing, but something we call super staffing. And super staffing says, if you had a pharmacist for 18 cents an hour, what would you do today that you don't do today? Well, I would call every patient 2 days after they start taking a new medication. Right? How you doing? Any side effects we should know about? Oh, don't worry. That side effect's normal. It'll go away in a few days. Or, oh no, that's very unusual, you know, but I've actually noticed that there's another medication that doesn't have that same side effect. Let me notify your physician. Maybe he can switch you to that. Like, there's, you know, we would significantly increase adherence probably from just making these phone calls. Why don't pharmacies do that today? They make only a few dollars a prescription. There's no way the math works, and there aren't enough pharmacists to do it. So, like, that's an example of a super staffing idea that we're literally doing. And we're saying, hey, let's just check in. It's not diagnoses. It's just a conversation. We can pass it all to the physician if there's something of note. But nobody takes the time to call and just check in and make sure everything's okay. The second thing is, we believe you can do things like having a preoperative conversation. Like, do we really need to use our valuable, rare nurse time to call patients to say, have you started taking your prep for your colonoscopy? And did you remember to stop taking your blood thinners? And did you remember to, like, that you are only supposed to have clear liquids? You know, I'm not a physician here. I just took a class at Stanford. So, you know, we do have on our team, my other co-founder is our chief medical officer. And he used to be the chief operating officer at El Camino Hospital here in Silicon Valley, and did his MD at Johns Hopkins and was an emergency room physician. So, like, you know, we go to him when we have these questions. But you know, imagine you have this ability to have healthcare at 18 cents an hour. Like, there's so much more we can do. We could reach out to every senior every week and just check in. My mother is 81 years old, and she has knee pain. And she had this one rash, and, like, we didn't check in with her, you know, and it got really bad. And we ended up having to take her to the ER because the rash got so bad. She was literally bleeding because she has itches so much. And I had called her and I'd said, hey, are you okay? And, you know, those weeks it was fine. Oh, you know, it's kind of itching, but it feels like it's getting better. And I got this new medication, and it was, but I didn't check in with her every other day. And had I, you know, I feel really guilty as a child, right? I'm like, oh my God, I should have called my mom every day. I could have avoided this ER visit. But actually, as people get older, like, their health cycles change so frequently, even day to day, that they would actually benefit, you know, maybe not calling him every day, but at least once a week.
Well, although they always love to hear from their kids every day, I'm sure.
They do. I love to hear from the kids. But they're also terribly lonely at that age, and actually calling them, you know, and a language model at 18 cents an hour could also talk to them about their favorite topic for half an hour, right? You could talk to them about gardening for half an hour and the new heirloom tomato varieties that are out. And, you know, and, like, for some seniors, that would be a wonderful conversation. In fact, they might pick up the phone next time. Right. It's like, we want patient engagement, and yet we don't realize we're naggers. Like, we call, we nag them to take a med, and then we hang up. Well, why? Because at $90 an hour, we tell our nurses in the call center to get on the phone, get off the phone, right? Go on to the next call, please. But at 18 cents an hour, we could talk to you for half an hour. And then at the end, be like, hey, actually, you know, I almost forgot. The reason I called was to just make sure you have enough of your blah, blah, blah medication. Yeah. Do you need me to put in a refill? Do you need a ride to the next appointment? Like, there's so much we can do on chronic management if we just had infinite kind of capacity at very low costs. And I think that, anyways, that's our big idea. We think this is how we truly 10X, 100X the number of healthcare workers reaching out to patients.
When you're telling me all this stuff, it just reminds me, you know, right now, of course, there's a lot of this robot answering the phone for you. And what, you know, are we there when it comes to technology that somebody can have that kind of conversation? Because oftentimes with the robot, I'm just like, oh my God.
You don't want to talk to
you. Yeah. Call them, well, operator, and they're just like, the same thing. I was like, oh my God, hey, feel me now.
There's two reasons for that. There's two reasons it does. One is the voice quality. So let's talk about that. And the other is just its comprehension. And the problem with all of the deployed IVR systems, the voice systems you talk to and press one for this and two for that, is that the voice, the comprehension is very low. If you don't say it in exactly the right way, it doesn't work at all, right? But that has changed. I mean, and you can just see that with ChatGPT and just use those products and just chat. You can say things all different kinds of ways. We even have a working version here, the prototype that and you can say, it's like, oh, how are you feeling today? And I'm like, I'm feeling all right. You know, because, you know, what's the first answer everybody always says? Oh, yeah, I feel okay. And then they get into, oh, but actually my knee's really been hurting. You know, so I actually did one of these things where I like paused and I talked and I was unclear and it gets it every time. It's just the comprehension. I literally tell people, you have to think about the old chatbot was IQ 60. This one is IQ 130. It's a very different level of comprehension. The second is, does it sound good? And is the voice recognition good enough? But the voice recognition's come a long ways now. And the voice recognition is hard in an ambient setting, right? A physician in a room with a patient's different than on the phone. It's just the patient. So the voice recognition only really has one voice it has to deal with. Maybe there's a little background noise, but the background noise is much lower level of decibels than the foreground of the person talking. So it's actually much easier to separate. The other part is the speech synthesis. This has gotten so good. I think there's a new generation of speech synthesis coming that is so good that it does not sound like a robot. In fact, you can go to, there's a company called Lemon Labs. You can go there and play their demo on their site. It is amazing.
Okay.
It is absolutely amazing. And so I think that we've reached technology where I think we can at least attempt this. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it doesn't work, or maybe only 20% of patients are okay with it.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever. There's still a hell of a lot of value if we can do this for 20% of patients and check in on them regularly and talk to them and do their pre-op. And, you know, and you can do things you couldn't do. You know, think of like discharge instructions. Why do I tell you 3 days from now to make sure you change the bandage? Why don't I also call you 3 days from now and say, change your bandage today?
Yeah.
Right? Like, so you don't get an infection. Like, why don't we do that? Because we don't have infinite capacity. In fact, you know, one of our colleagues here, his mom recently got a knee replacement and got discharged from a local health system here that's a very good health system. Didn't get one phone call. The doctor didn't call. The hospital didn't call. Got a customer service IVR thing that called, but not one phone call. And she had a lot of questions, his mom. And they're little ones. Oh, do I do this? I do that. Is it all right? You know, can I ice it? Like, you know, little logistics that you have. It's your own treatment. But nobody called.
It's amazing how a little call actually goes a long way. So, yeah.
So I think there's a, I think what this technology is good at is conversational AI. And it turns out in healthcare, we can get a lot on conversation. Is we should stay away from diagnoses because it does hallucinate from time to time. But, you know, there's most of these activities are just checking in. Do you have enough medication? Do you need a ride? Do you need this? We're even looking at calling SDOH support while we're on the call with you. If I find out you're food insecure, what should I do? I should call the local food bank and see if they can deliver to you tonight. right? And what happens today? Well, the nurse gets off the phone and then spends another 20 minutes calling a bunch of food banks and then gets, oh, okay, they can deliver tomorrow at 4 o'clock or today at 5 o'clock or whatever. And then calls the patient back again, hopes the patient's there. Oh, yes, are you going to be home? Oh, yes, I am. Okay, and they call the, the food bank back and says, okay, he's going to be home. Please deliver. That's a lot of time.
So do you think this is something that you guys are working on right now that can have all this capability?
The SDOH integrations? Yeah. But, you know, we have to be very careful. We're trying to figure out how to, so there's this, we're just going to working with one food bank, kind of just starting to have the conversation. You know, how would you like us? Because we don't want to overwhelm you with phone calls either. But how would you like us to reach out? They have qualifying questions. Food banks don't just send out food.
Right, I hope so.
Right? They have qualifying questions. So they're, you know, maybe we can get those questions from them and we can ask the patient already those qualifying questions and save them the time. So there's some intelligent ways to do this. But I think that, there's a ton that can be done here and we should try doing it. And then remember, these things can speak every language with the right training. So imagine we can find all of your underserved groups that speak certain, like even my own mom, you know, she would probably prefer to speak Gujarati, which is her dialect from the state India she's from, than to speak Hindi, and probably prefer to speak both either Gujarati or Hindi than speak English if somebody was calling her. And I bet you if you called her up and you spoke to her in either Hindi or Gujarati, she would speak to you way more likely than if you called her up and spoke to her in English. I mean, she speaks English fine, but she doesn't prefer it.
So do you think this is something when you deploy that, implement this, the person who received the call, will they know that this is not a real person or is this something that is a shift of?
No, you definitely tell. We literally, our introduction right now is, hi, this is so-and-so, you know, this is Dr. Shah's AI nurse calling. Or this is, you know, or you know, Dr. Shah's virtual assistant calling you. Like you share it with that. We are looking at intelligent ways to introduce people to it though, because that might change adoption, right? Like should I introduce you to it right as you're being discharged, right? You know, say, hey, I'm going to just put you on, you know, on speakerphone right now with the virtual assistant. Just say hello. Oh, hi, this is a virtual assistant. You know, anything else I can answer about your discharge instructions? I know the nurse just went over it with you. No big deal. But, you know, I'm here anytime. You can call me. Here's my number. And by the way, I'm going to call you every day. What's a good time for me to call you? Oh, 9 a.m. every morning? All right. I'll call you every morning for the next 5 days to just help you walk through that day's discharge instructions. Just remember my voice, okay?
It will be the same voice through and through, and then you'll be like a buddy for different procedures that you have.
I mean, well, and you can have a CRM element too, right? Which is just like, it'll remember last time I told my story. And patients love telling their stories, right? That's one of the keys to bedside manner is you listening to their stories, but physicians don't have the time. And so, you know, and they always tell long stories, right? But it's not I fell down on my bike and hurt my knee. They're like, there I was going down the hill at 30 miles an hour on, you know, Skyline Boulevard. And yeah, I mean, they tell these very elaborate stories. I think it must be a therapeutic part of how we heal because we share our story in immense detail. And I'm sure physicians and nurses are like, all right, you know what? I don't need to know all that detail. What I need to know is the pain coming or going? Is the pain? It's like very specific. And then they cut them off and the patient feels very
not hurt.
Kind of hurt, right?
And maybe the patient feel that I need to give them all information because I don't know which information is relevant. So I'm going to just data dumped on the doctor.
I mean, it's certainly that. I mean, but there's a lot there, but I think that, again, the language model has the infinite patience. In fact, if you talk to these things, you find something actually. There's this author, Harari, who...
The Yuval.
I don't say his name right. The Yuval, who wrote Space Sapiens. And he was being interviewed by Lex Fridman the other day. And he said, are you scared of AI? And he said something to the effect of, yes, but not for the reasons you think. I'm not scared of the Terminator AI taking over. what I've come to realize is these things pay such perfect attention to you. And in our lives, we have nothing that pays that level of undivided attention that he's like, this thing's going to be so seductive because we're going to prefer. But just this idea, you know, it's, and when you talk to our thing, like you say five things and it addresses all five things. You're like, wow, it really heard me. Mm-hmm. And when you do that with a human, you never get that, right? It'll ignore it, or the human's on their iPhone, or they're distracted. And so anyways, I think that there's a level of attention it gives you, which we never get in real life and we desperately crave.
Maybe that will solve the problem that everybody would feel that they're hurt. And because of that, they feel supported. And because they feel supported, they become a kinder and gentler person to society.
Yes. Or at least at a minimum, at least in a healthcare setting, because they feel supported and heard, they take their meds.
Yeah.
They're supposed to. Like, I'll settle for that.
So
I'm like, just please, like, I don't think in America we have a problem of diagnoses. I mean, we do in some rare cases, but we really, you know, but by and large, we do a pretty darn good job of diagnoses, like, and especially of our chronic diseases. Like, really, do we misdiagnose diabetes that often? No, it's not a very hard diagnosis, right? Like, so yeah, sure, in some subtle cases, and you know, I'm sure there's somebody who's an expert that'll be like, well, Manjal, actually, you know, but I mean, look, for 80% of people, like, it's a pretty clean diagnosis. Our problem is the adherence to the care plan. That's our problem. That's really the problem we have. And so
that's really fascinating and exciting to hear that you're working on that. It's definitely the labor shortage, which is also causing a lot of the patient don't get the attention. So I'm glad that, you know, to hear that.
And you can combine the roles. So today, if I have a billing question and I'm talking to the nurse, but she's trying to get me to come in and do this other scan, let's say, but really, I don't know what my copay is going to be. And that's really why I don't want to do the scan. And right. Then, I mean, that certainly happens. Yeah. Right. So now I got to go to the billing department. I got to be transferred. Mm-hmm. Because my nurse doesn't know about my insurance plan. My nurse doesn't know about my bill. And the billing person doesn't know about my health record because for HIPAA reasons, we didn't want to give them that access because that's a different level of staff usually. But the LLM can know it all.
Well, that's nice.
And right? It's right there in that same conversation. What do you want to do? Well, I don't know if I can afford it. Well, actually, you know, looking at your current plan you're on and looking at da-da-da-da and, you know, like, I think actually this should only be a $200, you know, or $100, you know, whatever, copay for you. Is that something you can afford? If not, you know, I can also right now connect you to this assistance program and we can find out if maybe they can help you with, like, you can do all that.
Yeah.
Well, no, we're training our language model on every single 200-page PDF of every healthcare plan in the country.
Okay. Well, that's...
Like, we're not just, I mean, those, it's all available, but you have to train it to know those plans. We're training it on every CMS regulation, every menu in the country, every, like, it isn't just medical data we're training it on. We're training it on healthcare data, i.e. all the, we're training it on every DME, every durable medical device, like which ones are good, which ones are bad, which ones have these problems, what are the reviews on them? Like, we're just feeding it all into our LLM because we're like, well, that's another question people ask, right? Like, which walker should I get? So anyways, there's a lot here we can do and we can help with if we just really think expansively about the idea of what knowledge the LLM has and what conversations.
So when are you guys rolling it all out?
When it's safe is the short answer. People are always like, when are you rolling it out? I'm like, well, I can't really say that we're safety first and then say it's coming out on this date because it really has to come out when it's safe. And but we're taking a different approach to safety. We're doing what we call a bottoms-up safety. And so the bottoms-up safety says, hey, you know, who's best to decide a language model is safe to be a, you know, to check in on people about their medications, let's say, or to check in on? Well, the people who do that today, be that a nurse or be that a pharmacist, in that example. Or, you know, who's there to decide it's safe enough to be a dietitian? Okay, well, a dietitian. So we're actually getting this, we've recruited, you know, hundreds of these folks and we're continuing to recruit, we're not done. And we're actually having them chat with the large language model. And we don't tell them whether it's a person or not in this case, because this is a controlled test with a professional, mm-hmm. this is with a patient. And then at the end, we're like, do you think the thing you just talked to is good enough to talk to patients? Mm-hmm. Like we act like it's a training scenario where they're coaching and training another nurse, another dietitian. And then at the end, we say, do you think it's good enough in this kind of blind taste test? And if they say yes, then we say, great. When we get enough of them as a percentage saying yes, that's when we'll release it. Because our belief is the only person who can judge safety is the clinician who does the mm-hmm. job today.
Yeah. Well, that's exciting. I'm looking forward to that day when.
Yeah. Well, and some roles might come out much sooner than others. We might be like, oh, it's okay to do a preoperative call for a colonoscopy, but we can't quite get it to work right for a knee replacement. There's too many other complicating things and it doesn't do it right. So we will build these almost procedure by procedure, kind of condition by condition, test them and then only put them out for certain ones. And probably the easier to understand, the less complex ones will come out first.
I know I'm like running short on time. I can, talk to you for a long time because I have a lot of questions that you have very interesting insight. I did want to mention, ask you a little bit about your comment about EMR, but then I think I'll save it for some other time. but I was just thinking about, you mentioned about your first healthcare company that did not go out the way as your first or second entrepreneur's journey. How is that lessons learned that now you're doing on your, the next big thing here? What lessons that you learned from there?
Some of them are just financial. As a company gets big, there's a lot of financial engineering you have to do. And in that case, we grew the business using a lot of debt because debt was very cheap. And then debt, all of a sudden, as the Fed raised interest rates a ton, became not very cheap. And that was a real challenge for the business to kind of do it. But I think the bigger issue was, you do realize that so much of healthcare typically does need a lot of people. And that was part of what we were doing. We were selling Medicare policies to seniors. And we had a really unique AI technology that we used where we would import the health record of the senior to decide which of the 50 Medicare Advantage plans were best for them. Mm-hmm. We literally analyzed their ICD codes and say, all right, they have these diagnoses. For these diagnoses, which plan tends to cover things better than the other plan? They need to see specialists for those diagnoses. Which plan has most specialists in network? Because most of your Medicare Advantage plans are very narrow network mm-hmm. plans. And so we did a really good job of that. But we did realize, one of the lessons out of that was co-pilot's really hard, which is why I've talked to you mostly about staffing ideas where we don't need it to be a co-pilot. Because what we found was the agents who were talking to people about their Medicare plans, even though the algorithm would say, this is the best plan for this person, she will save the most money out of pocket, she will get the most access to doctors that they need, it has the cardiac rehab that she might need and all the other plans don't have cardiac rehab coverage, like the agents would still mm-hmm. sell largely the plan they knew best and that they had sold for the last 10 years at the last 10 places they worked selling plans. And even though the thing would be flashing red and say, you must sell this plan, and even though our commission plan to them was aligned to make sure they sold the plan that was the best true plan, and we got paid the same amount for every plan from every carrier, so we didn't have any financial incentive to sell one plan or another. We just wanted to sell the right plan. I've really learned that a lot of the workflow process ideas of using AI are very hard. And that that's why ChatGPT was so exciting to me, is I said, oh my God, you finally have an IQ 130. You might, at least for some narrow use cases, be able to build kind of a more automated version, still with a bunch of safety kickouts. Like if you say certain things, even our model will kick you out to a real human. But that's still very different than in the loop. And in the loop ideas only get you so much. Because you're already short doctors and nurses. So in the loop means you can only get like a 10%, 20% efficiency versus, here I could give a chronic care nurse to every single person in the country that has two or more chronic diseases, all 68 mm-hmm. million of them. And just like that's a really big idea. Like, let's go try and do that. And maybe we don't succeed in that. But at least the grandeur of the of what we're trying to do is there, and the impact we could have in healthcare is there. And I think that that's those are some of the. I mean, honestly, I learned like 100 other lessons, but in the end, you just I care a lot about trying to improve healthcare, and so regardless of whether things work or don't work, I'm like, well, it's my job to try again to try to make an impact because that's the only way I improve patient lives is to try.
That sounds good. Well, thank you. Thanks for your time and thanks for sharing your story and a really exciting work that you're doing right now.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.